So I'm hoping in the course of doing this, not only to present you with some of the ideas, things that I looked at and thought of, but to hear from you and give you a chance to talk about how that comes together for you. The topic today is nurturing, and in particular what I want to look at are some of the primary practices of Christian communities of faith, and how we might think of those in relationship to this work of caring and raising children. As some of you may know, if you are Lutheran, and I suspect I can assume that a significant number of you are, but I do not assume that everyone is, but in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, amongst the many things that will occupy people at our next assembly in Philadelphia next month, is a statement on sacramental practices that there are so many things going on, and everybody has a kind of different piece of the action that gets them excited. So we've heard a lot about the ecumenical work and proposals, but in recent years, one of the studies the church undertook in its early formation, and I can't think of a more central piece to its identity as a community of faith, is looking at the sacraments. It's a very accessible piece, not only for those who in some sense are responsible for the right administration of the sacraments, but for communities of believers who want to think about what they do and why they do it, what they might need to do differently, what they're trying to accomplish. And it's, I think what it makes is such an important distinction here, was it's one thing to know about something, and it's another thing the kind of knowing that comes in doing it. And I think that the sacraments are really a challenge to us, because many of us would have to recite to say certain things about what they mean. But then there's also a question about how will we do them in ways that express that meaning, that sort of teach it. These are really sort of the rituals that are important for the very formation of our identity. So what this statement was doing is saying, let's look at the diversity of practices that have come into this church, who's doing what, where have the disagreements been, and speak with some clarity about what we have learned and where we think the future might take us. So that is going to be voted on in August. And I think that it's a time of flux for both sacraments, both baptism and the Holy Supper, partly because, as many of you probably realize, we live in a society now where many people are not simply inactive, but just downright unchurched. The pastor of the congregation I belong to talks about people who come in that he calls new Christians, who really know very little. And so the rite of entry of baptism, which for Lutherans and for many of our Protestant communities, as well as Roman Catholics, Episcopalians, has been administered to infants, suddenly, although that has been our norm, we're having enough of the other practice, because people are coming to us at later stages in their lives, that we're thinking more broadly about baptism. And I think with the Holy Supper, one of the big issues has been appropriate age of communing, right? And what does it mean to be appropriately prepared? What I'm going to do at some point this morning is sort of run around here and find out what it's like where you are, because I think we'll all be kind of stunned. There is a lot of variation and some lack of clarity for people about what we should be doing. But my comments only say this is what I call, it's a transition stage. And for those of you here last week, I was talking about Lutheran teachings on communion and the move. I grew up in a congregation where we communed 4 times a year. And I'm not that old. I was confirmed in the mid-60s, right? And I was communed for the first time after I was confirmed, 4 times a year, then they moved to 6. By the time I was in college, they were dabbling with once a month. And now they've kind of made it to twice a month, and then they pick certain seasons of the year and they do it every week. But you can imagine the span of persons in that one congregation who have been formed with a particular practice, right? And what I'm saying is we don't have, there's this kind of, and my mother is often a great grounding for me. She's a bright, committed woman with a good critical eye and is what I think typical of a parishioner and not somebody who does this for a living. And it's just, you know, my mother one time when I was home visiting, I fell ill with the flu and I was really quite sick, but it was the Sunday after Christmas and they were still singing Christmas carols, which as much to my parents' horror, since you can't sing them in Advent, my father finds a form of unhelpful legalism. Generally, they get to everything they can during the Christmas season, but my mother offered to stay home with me, and I said, oh, no, please go ahead, you know, because, and she said, well, to tell you the truth, honey, they've been having communion every Sunday in Advent, and I'm really all communioned out. And I thought, I mean, that this was a very honest, what she was saying is, I simply don't have a framework of meaning to embrace what's going on there. And I'm not saying they shouldn't do it, but I'm not going. I'm not going this time. And she said, I think this is a perhaps more tasteful way than if I went to church, stayed in the pew, and didn't commune, especially if your father does, because then they'll really wonder what I did. Right? So I think, though, that's what I want to say, is that we're in a stage of taking these central practices, and that's what we need to understand. They are not fixed in stone about the one way they can be meaningful and how they ought to be exercised. But it is my argument, and one of the things I think is estimable in this statement, is that it is looking to the future. It is saying, in some ways, the people we have to have an eye on is how do these central practices of the church work and shape those we want to be formed in Christian faith and come along. And the circumstances in which you and I are seeing young people in our church try to come to maturity as Christians are vastly different from what they were before. When I was going, nobody didn't go to confirmation. I didn't grow up in Minnesota. I mean, I was not in an environment where it was a real thoroughgoing Lutheran identity. But that was just a given. That was expected. We didn't question it. There were ways in which the patterns of how we would be involved in congregational life were as natural as knowing when you went out for recess at school, when you were old enough to play a brass instrument. You know, all those things that you do. Now I think of times when just I've tried to plan something in a church, and I look at the number of demands and options for young people of where will be a community that gives them identity, and they may well prefer hockey. Or they may work. So that we're recognizing that what we need, we don't have as much to presume on. You know what I mean? That they will be there. So do we need to think about this differently? I think that's one of the challenges before us. People didn't question baptizing when they had a baby. People surprisingly omit that. I've had pastor friends who tell me the kids show up for First Communion class and don't know whether they were baptized. And when they go home and ask, they will honestly get questions like, well, some of you were done, but I'm not sure which ones. And I don't mean to make fun of, I don't mean to make fun of these people, but to say it that would have been unthinkable when I grew up. Just unthinkable. As my friend said, what she's learned from it, you better keep parish records worth their salt, because you may be the only record of these matters. Right? So it's here, I think, looking at both, one of the big debates among Christians in our society now is, this conflict that goes back to the Reformation, Luther, the so-called magisterial Protestants, those who introduced reform, engaging what could be seen as the powers of the world, the magistrates, why they were called magisterial. In Luther's case, the prince. And who understood that their vocation as Christians called them into full engagement with the world. Okay. What we have is another group known as the radicals, or in some cases they were called the left wing. And one of the hallmarks of this movement, and a key example would be the Anabaptists, or what we know as Baptists, different, but They insisted that the first step to securing the integrity of the Christian community was to sever the connection between the church and the state. That you could have no power of coercion in a society at large to keep people Christian. Now, it's funny, that could sometimes be formally by law, which it clearly was in some of those places, or if you didn't have a confirmation certificate, you didn't get a job, you know. Or it can be more informal, but has the same effect, right? That's what we call this sort of kind of social Christendom. I mean, you know, that it's expected and people do it. There's enough, you know, to keep order. But what's interesting is even though Lutherans, Presbyterians, right, we come out of the Magisterial Reformation, the radicals won their greatest battle here. Because one of the bases of the formation of this country was indeed to honor that separation. That the government, the powers that be, would not enforce or favor or actually, you know, put a handicap on any group. Now, the radicals believed that this meant a certain kind of separation from the diluting influences and indeed, at points, just polluting influences of the world. So that persons in the community would have a distinct identity as disciples. It would be their primary identity. And in some ways, it had to pit them against the things of the world. Now, to different degrees, they were able to carry this out. But what we find now, I think, in some of the contemporary debates, is in a way this question comes back, as many of the best questions of history do, to haunt us in a new form. What the radicals said to Luther, who said to them, you're no better than monks. You pull yourselves away, you abandon the neighbor, you worry about your own purity. They said, well, I guess we don't want that to go too far, but you fool yourself if you think that you can engage the world without becoming like it. Because little by little, you make the compromises and you can always find a reason for selling out. Now think of some of the arguments we hear in this country around me. Those are exactly the things that are being pressed at people. You couldn't possibly tolerate that for the sake of a neighbor who's not like you without, you know, really betraying your Christian faith. So one of the arguments, what do we have to think about as a community of nurture, a formation of identity, in giving those who come into our community of whatever age, but especially the young, a clear enough sense of who they are as disciples of Christ, that they can, I mean, engage that world, but for example, the choice of going to confirmation class or playing hockey would move them to the point of saying that is an unfair choice for you to put before me. To have a sense of being, and I think we don't realize how very hard it is for many of our young people sort of to understand why is this important and who am I? And I'm always worried in this is that you go home and think, oh God, there's another thing I'm not doing right. You know, as a parent, this is a place wherever it becomes clear that this is not the work of parents or grandparents alone. This is the one, right? You just can't do it alone. But this is where I think if we look at, and I'm all for how do you make church more, you know, comfortable for children? What kinds of things do you offer them? I mean, I do think it's wonderful when you have preschools. Our congregation has one. It's an incredible entree for kind of giving parents a sense. But these are important, but I think of them in some ways as add-ons. I want to go to the heart of the matter. Right? It's not enough that there's a good Sunday school program. What about these very acts by which Christ founded and defined his church? What should they be for children? So I want to talk a little bit about baptism and how you might think about it and some of the ways I find, I think, not always successful. Paul, on the first day we were together, commented that when his daughter was born, one of them, of three, these three perfect daughters, I couldn't even tell which one this was. But he said that when he had some kind of, he realized how he bridled at this suggestion, just a medical condition of an infection, that there was something wrong with this perfect child, you know? And I think that, I mean, what we have to look at is, you don't get very far. If you talk to people who encourage them to come into a community saying, as I said to one of my friends who was going to embroider something for Lucy's room as a biblical verse, I said, please don't pick the one that says, in sin my mother bore me. That's not what I want hanging above my daughter's crib. And that this isn't going to be sort of the first word we say, but how do we think about what this act means and why it is important? And how you might articulate that to somebody who's not sure of it, and also what you will tell your children about what it means that this was done for them. Now, this definition of sin, I think we live in a society, I don't know that American society is greatly different from others. I haven't lived other places, but my contact with persons from them has always suggested that they're kind of astonished at the sort of moralism of Americans. I mean, that on one hand, they're sort of sensationalist, but, you know, on the other, there are these certain things that they just go berserk about as being, you know, really sinful. And that I think what's important here is then when we look at this as an accumulation of nasty acts, that it is very hard to make this meaningful about the arrival of a child. Of course that is hard to make meaningful to persons. But that the definition that our confessional tradition gives us of sin is that it is an inability to fear, love, and trust God. It is something into which we are born. I mean, I think it's a hard one to conceive of, but oftentimes I don't even think of it like I've got this defect in me, but that's the condition of the world into which I come. Remember yesterday when we talked about mirroring? If there's nobody around me who's really able to do it because that's the human condition, I can't get it right either. And that it's the kind of poisonous sense of how that spills out into all our relationships is, I think, what the confessions are getting at. So when they talk about the writing, God reconciling the world, right? If you said, here are the pieces, here's God, here's the object, the person, the sinner, we're sinners in community, here's the relationship between them. What I often think about is what the confessions are getting at is the thing that changes is that relationship. We don't get made perfect. It's not that something yucky gets removed from us, nor is it that really we have a God who is wrathful, who finally is satisfied by a sacrifice of his son. More complicated to talk about what this is, this misperception of us towards God, of being unable to see God truly, and to trust in God's ability to love. So that this is the thing that they are arguing is at the root of the problem, and it has these endless communal consequences. The other term I found very helpful in that one is that Luther often described the sinner as being turned in on him or herself, cravatus in se. Now, this is almost to think about what is it like, some of you, I'm sorry to repeat myself because you were here last week, you heard this, a friend of mine who has a daughter, we talked about the monocular vision the other day, that when her daughter when she adopted her, she had severely crossed eyes, and when they first picked her up at the orphanage, this little girl had sort of no contact with them, and my friend wrote me, and you could tell she was worried whether there was something more amiss, you know, in terms of her inability to. When they got her back to the States, had her eyes operated on, and in several weeks, she made dramatic strides forward, and my friends laughed, and she called me, and she said, I suppose it's asking a lot to expect somebody to interact with her parents and her world when all she can see is the bridge of her nose, right? But Sarah didn't know, right, that. And I think what I'd like to offer that as an image for what it is that we're sort of born spiritually that way. That's the point here. And it's not something we could do otherwise. In many ways, it's something we don't even know what's absent because we can't see it. right? So that baptism in that respect, now here's another piece I want to be very clear about. One of the things that drives me crazy is if you've ever been with a child who's lost it and is behaving in these unbelievably selfish, egocentric, mean-spirited ways, verbalizing these horrible things so that people say to you, yeah, children, nice. You know, if you have any doubts about original sin, behold, you know, and there they are going at each other. And I think we have to be very careful not to give moral valuation to normal developmental sequences. I think one has to be very careful with that. Right? Because there's another way in which we are naturally creatures that unfold. And we learn. And it was very helpful, as somebody once pointed out to me, there's all the difference in the world between being with a four-year-old and being in relationship with an adult who acts like a four-year-old. Right? So I think we want to be careful there as we talk to parents, because I've heard people do that. Look at how all they care about is themselves. Look how focused. Well, for heaven's sake, so is a baby kitten. I mean, they die if they don't attend to things like getting fed. I mean, and so I think we want to be careful there. Or even the signs of things we see in our children that can be disturbing, not leaping to these conclusions about here is the seed of evil brewing, you know, because they are so violent in what they say. But they are exploring territory. That's what I'm saying, is that we want to dismiss it, but how do we give it meaning? And there, I think an important part in talking about baptism is what it means for the future. Baptism is an initiation into the journey. Okay? And when I was talking to Deanne Lagerquist, who is my chalet mate, she told me once, she said, you know, her mother has said, from the moment your baby is born, it is all a process of learning to let go. That in truth, that's what parenting is about. There is a way in which it seems to me that the act of baptism, clearly as significant as it is for the recipient, in this case a child we're talking about, but also as parents, that what it is at this moment, in some sense, both to claim one's responsibility for this child and to have to let go of this child, is this child belongs to a bigger circle than the one that you and I and our family will offer. And that right from the beginning, one is mindful, and it's kind of bittersweet. I mean, but it's also a great comfort that this child already stands in some ways as on an equal footing with you and me in this communion of saints. And then it is a recognition, I think, of two-way, this sort of bifocal vision of the world. I gave a question on an exam in Lutheran's Confessions this last semester where I had students, I said, this is your case, your test case. You go to visit a family with a newborn daughter in whom they can discern no fault. And they're talking about baptizing her. What would you say to them about the church's understanding of sin? And one of the most beautiful, which is only to say we should have more and more people with families in seminary, as complicated as it could be, came from a man in the class who has a 12-year-old daughter. I asked him later. And he said, I think what I would talk about to them is to say, this isn't about what's amiss, sort of thing. I said, but what this is what you know will come in the future. That there will come a moment when she will know the good and find herself unable to do it. Or she will recognize a world, things that cannot be turned back from things that are harmful. She will taste then what it is to be in bondage to sin. Sometimes by personal commitment, sometimes by default, you just happen to be there. And this will be the thing that will set a bottom below, which she won't drop, about the truth of sin and the power of grace and the possibility of hope in the face of it. And I thought that was a very profound thing to offer, to say, because we all know it gets worse. You know, I mean, that things that we can't begin to, a child couldn't begin to understand about what this will mean. But there's a way in which this community begins to shape them to survive that truth. Now, the other side I want to talk about is, lest we make it sound like the world is kind of a nasty steeplechase where it's just one crap after the next you hope they'll miss, is the other side, I think, is an important way we think about that. One of my, a theologian who moved me profoundly, Friedrich Schleiermacher, whom I did not read a great deal in seminary, but encountered, as you often do in graduate school, you have to read people on these lists that you're sort of surprised at what you find. Schleiermacher had a son. He lived right at the turn of the 19th century. So he died, I think, in about 1826. I think that's right around then. And so, and he had married, rather, he had a little boy late in his life named Nathaniel. And Nathaniel died very suddenly when he was about 8 years of age. He contracted some kind of a fever, and it went like that. And Schleiermacher preached the funeral sermon at his grave. One of my friends said, it kind of makes you wonder what kind of pastor the congregation had. And he said, there's no way I'm going to hear what that guy would say. I'd rather do it myself. Because it's an extraordinary act of courage. But when I think of people making a good confession, it is one of the most powerful confessions to me I've ever heard. For someone to take that moment and say, I will speak what is in my heart and what I know. And he says several things. He said, you know, I know people mean well, but when they come and say to me, oh, it's such a dangerous, troubled world, thank good your child is safely beyond it, I don't find that helpful. He also didn't like the ones who said, you know, you'll be together on heaven's shore. He said, you know, for some people, those kinds of images of the afterlife may be appealing, but for one of my education and temperament, it's saying more than I think I can say. He holds on to that bear, we know not yet what we shall be, but when he comes again, we shall see him as he is. And he said, that's what we have to hold on to. And I can't go, what I have with Nathaniel here, I cannot promise myself I will have again. But he comes back to that one about, aren't you glad he's out of here? And he says, already at his young age, Nathaniel had started to come to know his Savior and speak of him. And he said, why would I wish him out of a world that has been hallowed by the Redeemer's presence? Said, and even though there would have been difficult things that would come ahead, he said, I was prepared to face them all with him. Did I have any reason, why would I doubt that the Lord Jesus Christ would have been with us in the journey? So it ends in this sort of tragic way of saying, there isn't a lot of comfort here. There's an incredible amount of loss. And in the end, it's almost as if he comes up against that bar, you know, of looking beyond to say, someday we'll be together again. And he turns people back from it. And he says, so my word to you is love each other as those who could be so quickly torn away. A profound, it seems to me, affirmation of what can happen here. And to me, I remember being so struck when I read that, thinking, the incarnation, he was here, wasn't he? You know, and he didn't leave because it was gross. You know, I mean, he came because it was worthy in God's eyes. And is it not a different place because it happened? What is it then to say to a child, by this act, we have joined you, brought you into this hallowed life, this hallowed living of what this world can be. So it seems to me those are some of the important pieces as we think about what baptism means as a beginning and how it might be followed through and how it might be drawn upon as we talk to our children about a daily return to baptism. As sort of, you know, I think when you were children, you'd play that game, you know, where people, and there would be the no, the safe spot, you know, sort of the no person, you know, and I'm at base, and you can, that there's a way sometimes when, that's what I like to think about coming back to this baptism. It's a base, it's a place to take your bearings, to take account, and to know that you cannot be harmed. You know, know that, that you've been marked and you are held in God's embrace. I think that both for the children about whom we care and for ourselves in the strenuous task of doing that, this idea of baptism could be very powerful. We can draw off it in rich ways, both in family commemorations as well as within our worshiping communities. So, moving from there, let's talk about communion. I don't think too many people have a big deal about baptizing infants. I think it's often what we get it, we make reason why we do it, and then people aren't quite sure what to do with it after they've got it. And I think it's a very powerful thing. You watch, when somebody's baptized in your congregation, I do this if you say, that was done to you. You know, and, well, what did I do? And what was, and who was there? And what was in, and here's this piece from this, and here's that. So that I see in a way that the eagerness often of these children, especially when somebody else is baptized, like, oh, you're one of us, sort of, that I think it has more power for identity than maybe we realized in their feeling connected. With communion, of course, the question has been, when are people appropriately prepared to take it? What is an age where it was meaningful? I'd be interested to survey how many of you were communed for the first time after you were confirmed. So probably at about, depending on what, 14, through somewhere around there, depending on how long, our confirmation was 3 years, 7th, 8th, and 9th grade. So we were 14 and 15. How many were communed, say, around 5th grade? Anybody started communion younger? Yeah. I know you're Roman Catholic. How about you?
I was.
Yes. See, and so there's, you can, now, those of you who have children who are communing, let's just start back. How many have children who are communing who are age 7 to 10? Yeah. Anybody have children communing below the age of 7? Now, people whose children, and please don't be embarrassed again, but whose children aren't communing yet, who are older than that, say, on that first pattern that we've described, where that's what's at work in your congregation, that it's after confirmation. Is anybody in that situation?
I think in our, I don't have any, not even a grandchild involved, but I don't think they still do it until they're after confirmed.
Yeah.
That's in the town in Minnesota.
Yes. Now, what I want is, just looking at that and looking at the ages in this room, can you see what a dramatic shift in some ways we're having? And that you have to recognize that you were given a framework of meaning coming into your confirmation, first communion, or whatever, and in a way now you have to give a different pattern to your children than what was. And so cut yourself some slack right there. That's hard. It's one of the things I noticed that people talked about. Well, they feel so deprived. Well, when my brother and I were little, we never felt deprived. But we weren't invited up. But see, now here's one of the things I used to think is it's a matter of having a space that's your own. The delight of the children when we were there, and all the parents had to be in line going on, and we got to look at everything that we had been curious about that they wouldn't let us grab, and they couldn't do anything. It was a very empowered moment. I mean, I know that sounds funny, but it really was. And I can still remember my brother just saying, let's see if we can slide all the way from one end to the other. One good shot. They're only halfway up in the line. And recognizing that when you come back from communion, that we had the piety on our side. That the last thing in the world they could do is sit down and grab you by the wrist and yell at you. They had to bow their heads quietly in prayer. So I just laugh about that to say, Ezra, I want to be careful that it wasn't actually that we felt excluded. So what I want to be clear here is, again, not to say, oh, we have been doing it wrong for years, and you and I are all defective, sort of, but to say it is an act, again, capable of a variety of meanings, depending on how it's placed. and I think has to be in dialogue in many ways with what our children are experiencing in a wider world of what it, how they, what we know about how they learn, how people approach them in their schools or whatever. This is the case, I quoted yesterday that Alice Miller thinks that one of the really revolutionary things about our generation now, I mean, is that we know so much more about how human beings are formed and learned that just wasn't known before. To think about how we might use this act most fruitfully or constructively in the lives of young people. And it is out of that, let me say, that I think has arisen this sort of debate that all of a sudden people are saying, well, first it was, they could know enough in fifth grade that that is a kind of a very fruitful moment for teaching, for them getting a bit mean, and that comes from some educational theory and work. But then people are saying, well, why 10 years old or 9 years old? That seems sort of arbitrary. What about, would it make more sense earlier? And of course, Orthodox Christians, remember when I say Orthodox here, I mean those of the Eastern branch of Christendom, Greek Orthodox, Russian Orthodox, have always communed infants. That, remember, the pattern of the church when it, in its early generations was that when people were prepared for entry into the church, and they would have been in that first generation or so, adult or converts, they went through the catechumenate, our equivalent of catechism, and then on the eve of Easter, at the Easter Vigil, a service, as you see, most of us, I suspect, never had growing up, if we were Lutheran or Protestant, that has come back, was a major service where they were received so that as the dawn of Easter rose, they would be baptized, they would be chrismated or sealed, which is what we do in confirmation, and commune for the first time. So what you have as the essential rite of entry in some ways, or the way of, is a kind of a tripartite act. And what changes, of course, is when suddenly you aren't bringing in just converts. This is what I think will be interesting, you see, as we have more adult converts. That's one of the, actually people are doing Easter vigils now with something other than babies. I mean, they really have adult to replicate that pattern. But that when the church went to the point, what you had were often adults, the majority of new membership came what? From the young, the reproduction of current members. It made, those things got divided up that originally were connected. And we were faced with a lot of questions about how do they relate? When should you do them? What gets accomplished when? That wouldn't initially have faced the Christian community. Okay. So the pattern of baptizing in infancy, eventually delaying communion, putting confirmation before the chrismation, and the invoking of the Spirit for the young. Now, one of the problems became now when we moved communion back before confirmation, how many of you have been in congregations where people think, what's the point of confirmation now? What is it, what are we trying to accomplish here? And of course it's difficult for us because in the old days it had a pretty clear trajectory. You know, you flunked, you didn't commune. It was very embarrassing. So now, and I remember even when I taught confirmation, and in my congregation, it was funny, they had just, I got there just so that I had first communion classes, and that was fine, but my confirmants hadn't communed. Okay. And they had no problem with the pattern being different. The one interesting one was I had a young guy who started coming to the youth group and decided he wanted to join the church. And he said, you know, Pastor Stroh, I've been looking at this. I said, my mom and dad are going to join the church. If I waited until after confirmation and just joined with them, I could, like, just join and commune, couldn't I? And I wouldn't have to do that. Oh. Well, he was right. I mean, he said, I don't want to do that because I think the class is kind of cool. But I thought, still, he thought that's an interesting loophole in how do you explain it, and I really couldn't. You know, that's, I think, the place where these are reasonable. What should we be doing and when and to what end? I think in many ways, what an argument that's being posed, and Paul Craig, I think this would be fair to say, is one of the things the sacramental practices statement is suggesting that we can let Holy Communion do a lot more of the work, in some sense, in the shaping and a formation of our children than we have let it do up to this point. And the divisions come, of course, because how many of us were taught that you had to receive in faith. Faith was largely defined as appropriate theological understanding about what was going on. If you didn't get it, you could at least recite it. How many of you had to recite? We had to go before the church council. We'd be asked questions, recite parts of the small catechism. Right? And that was it. What does this mean? You know, what is water? What is this kind? You know, and that about Holy Communion to be assured that, well, sure, we got it. I think we got some, but I'm just saying that. So that was a sort of a checkpoint that we understand. And the other thing was the instilling, I think, of a certain sense of awe. Because whatever else, there weren't too many things in the church that required an appearance before the church council as a prerequisite, right? And that suggests that this was very important. So I don't want to make light of this. I do not want to make light of this. Because it's a different pattern of forming meaning. Now, what I'm saying is that we had the construct pretty much all the way along that made sure we were there to get confirmed. See, that's one of the things I think is shifting, is that if you wait that long, it may be too late. The other issue that I think people know a lot more about now is how do children come? Remember, we talked about mirroring yesterday. If they look, in some sense, for an identity in the reflection of themselves in those who care for them, what does that say about how they might come to know themselves as included in this community and its central acts? And so that on one hand, you do have persons very concerned that if you commune young children who are nonverbal or really have no way of, are you putting them at risk because we are admonished to eat in faith and to discern the body? Or are we in some ways here applying a kind of an adult understanding of what that would mean and ruling out quite a wide range of how that might show itself? And that, here I come back to that distinction I made earlier about knowing about something and the knowing that comes from the doing, from the engagement in it. That the very meaning that it takes on comes over time because it's part of the rhythm and the shaping of our lives. I am a person who does this with my mom and dad and this group of people. Let me say that one of the comparisons, I thought, and you get a lot of this about table, I've heard some wonderful arguments where people say, well, on high occasions, we don't allow our children to eat at the table because they don't behave well. You know, and other people, as if somehow or other the sanctity of the supper, it has to do with it's a sort of Amy Vanderbilt approach. I mean, it's proper to cook. But I understand what they're concerned about. But here's the way I like to look at it. Think of how central this act of being fed and of eating together is. I can remember one time when I was in third grade, and my best friend Susan lured me out on the ice coming home from school, and I fell through in my new hush puppies, and she ran off and went home. And I cried out, struggled home with these there was the first day. My mother was home ill, and I crept into the house, and I heard this voice say, "Did you wear your new shoes today?" And I said, "No." I learned later that you just never ask children things that invite them not to tell you the truth. I was so terrified also because I thought I might drown, and that I couldn't tell, anything. I remember my mother coming in, and there they were, in creeks. Oh, and she was ballistic. Oh, just ballistic. And that night at dinner, I remember creeping out, and we were four of us, and my dad sat here, and Ralph sat here, and I sat here, and she said, "I'm so mad I'm not going to eat dinner sitting next to a liar." Oh, I hate to tell you how many decades ago this is. I still remember this. That's part of, now, the nice thing about now that I have it, I can understand exactly how my mother got to that point. I thought she was
overreacting. I don't anymore. But what I'm saying is, Lord, it was just the last straw. But what I'm saying is, the act of excommunication at the meal, just at a family meal, is unbelievable. And one of the tragedies, of course, in so many families, now I know people never eat together because they're all on these different schedules. But what it means to connect and identify, I mean, that was expected of us. You were home for dinner. We had tasks to do, and there were rituals around it. So getting moved to the other end of the table broke the ritual. I remember I was so touched because I realized my brother couldn't eat either. He was so upset, probably because he had to be so close to me. but I was saying, think about family occasions, the big holidays. Think about the rituals around how you serve a Christmas dinner or a birthday dinner. All these pieces, and how much, as a child growing up, this goes on the table here. We always have creamed onions for Grandma. We always do, well, when we have supper this time, there's a tree and the chrismons are on it. And when you go up, you get to go around this way because the table's all surrounded with poinsettias. You know, I think we need to look at it that it has some of that same central act of being fed and eating together, that we would be astonished at how children will take that in. This is the place where I belong. Yes, please, Paul.
I have good addition to that, Kills. Because I really appreciate your use of the statement. I just wanted to offer that I have multiple copies.
Oh, good. He was on the, yes, he was on the, yes.
If anybody would like to see me, or I can get you some copies, Jane.
Great.
I think the statement is at pains to emphasize the power of the acts. The other thing that happened as we worked that through was renewed appreciation for the nurturing power of language. Mm-hmm. And I think the one crisis of baptism I didn't hear you expound on is the person who comes seeking baptism, but desires no explanation of it.
Yes.
Demonstrates no understanding, no need of word around this, and the importance of our insisting that this is important enough to talk about.
Yeah.
And then the power that comes, the teaching power that comes around not only talking about baptism with Lucy as she sees other baptism, but talking about God. Mm-hmm. Because baptism assures her that this God is her God. And so we ended up expanding the statement
in response
to the means of grace.
Yeah.
So that it has a word section
as
well as baptism and table. Because the other thing we realized is that in large part, if families don't eat together, they don't talk to each other either.
No, that's a good point.
It is exactly where conversation and exchange and all of that nurturing and forming power.
And a good formation of identity. I mean, I think that's... And what I'm struck by is... This is what I'm going to be careful. I think we need to use careful discernment about what works in communities. But before we're so quick to think children don't know, I think all of us will offer very interesting ways in which children seem to get more. I mean, the children I read around here will say, are we eating with Jesus today? Well, I think that's a pretty good description of what happens there. And we were at church one Sunday where we had just the service of the word, and the pastors had finished and started to go out, and Lucy said, well, we haven't eaten with Jesus yet. Where do they think they're going? Isn't this loud? And I thought, I said, well, why don't you ask them on the way out?
There you go.
But what I'm saying is that not to underestimate, I mean, remember, when a child comes into the world, one of the fundamental things is to reach out for that which feeds. As a model of what we talk about eating with faith, one of my professors in seminary said, well, you know what eating with faith means at the supper? It means sticking out your hand and opening your mouth. That's what it means. That it goes beyond what we can articulate, and that for children, that is such a central part of how they do relate to the world. Think of what it is. We've talked about this thing, the very thing they need to worry about for survival. And they're more aware of it becomes the central act by which you can be sure that when you are here, you will be fed. Let me add one other piece. In a society where we commented, we talk a lot about caring about children, and it's a society that can be very dismissive of its children. I think most of us sitting, I mean, you look around and think of these, some of these children going, what hope have they? It is lacerating that what this does, in a way, is a powerful reminder from God to us, they are our equals. They are at this table as our equal. And that places some demands upon us as adults as to what needs to be done in the world and what our discipleship should be about. And I think that is not insignificant. Let me stop there. Question here, questions or comments?
Oh, please. I just had another comment that had really struck me when we were having the discussions with our pastor about this, was that he was talking about, you talk about, you know, children as if, what do they understand as opposed to adults? And then you, but your whole idea of adults coming in to be confirmed and new in faith, it's a maturity. You're trying to decipher a maturity or an understanding of faith. How do you know where anyone is?
Well, exactly.
At any point
yes.
in their life of
yes.
an understanding.
And that it fluctuates and it grows. I mean, I think that is an important part. You're quite right. I think one of the other things is always the sense that we'll explain to them and they'll get it. What I'm saying is that very often they will explain to us. I mean, they will have some witness to make around this that the community will hear to its benefit. Yes, Nancy.
Along the same lines, I really appreciate your comment about being very careful not to promote evaluation by developmental stages. And that goes all the way through adolescence, too, which makes it harder. In fact, the very pastor that Holly was just referring to, her pastor and my colleague and dear friend, grew up totally unreligious. And as a high school student, was brought to his youth group by a friend. And the reason he went was because all the girls he liked were in.
Well, remember, this is part of what it is to be created good.
So it's an adolescent hormone-driven conversion. allowing you to get to that place, how that looks like incarnational stuff, to in that
yes.
presence where you hear. And he was baptized then as a teenager. And also, from that has brought almost all of his sisters and brothers and his parents and everyone have also
yeah.
all been now, for all these many years, part of the community. So sometimes, I just love your how God has created us in this, and what we go through is all part of how God can address us.
Yeah, I think one of the arguments you get is that you at least have to be consistent with your sacraments. If you would bar people from communing on those grounds, frankly, you shouldn't baptize them either. I mean, that, you know, or you do, but which has been. But now what I want to say is, before I go high, there are people, remember, we have had a different practice. We've seen this in this room. And that what one wants to be very careful of is just recognizing that that's not sort of a cognitive thing that you sort out. That's what we're saying is, look how meaningful the practice is, so that when you say to some people, they're very worried about what this might mean. It actually supports the argument of how powerful these practices are. Yes, please, but we don't want to be disrespectful of another framework of meaning that has also served the church well. It's whether... Are there other possibilities, and how might that look? I think that's what that statement is pushing us to examine. Please.
The other end of the telescope is if you sensitize everyone in the congregation to the fact that indeed, by baptism, we are all equal, then what does that say about bickering, discussing the difference in the age? It's more immaterial. We're all equal together. Our congregation has revitalized itself because of our new pastor who has brought this concept to us. And not only in baptism, but in other practices of the congregational life. Ushering and things up at the altar and so forth.
So that all ages are engaged.
All in. And that has changed our whole concept. So that we realize and look at every youngster as co-equal, as very important. And start there, and then people can more rationally discuss whether it should be fifth grade, sixth grade, or what.
Because they see them and know them. That's helpful. Thank you. That's a very good point. You know, one of the other things I've often thought is that, in a way, I had some great confirmation teachers, and my mom and dad said a little bit, although my parents are sort of reticent people. I mean, I think they themselves sort of came to faith and maturity and it late, hardly feel like they're experts to speak about it. Problem was, if you graduated from confirmation, it's like nobody talked to you about those things anymore. That was why I realized that. I mean, in many ways, they thought, okay, well, now you're ready. That one of the things about this really is that it gives us so much time sort of to speak to these, and what intergenerational, even what it is. I did that with a confirmation. Interview somebody in the congregation who's at least 20 years older than you are. And how they were sort of shocked that they had anything to say. And fascinated about, well, what is it? Well, let me tell you how it's come to mean this for me or that for me, or what was their first communion like? What was, you know, that I think that we would engage and the power of our witness to one another, because in a way we all need that from each other. I think one of the sad things in our congregations is that we really, the mutual upbuilding and sort of, we could do that, but we don't often witness amongst ourselves to offer what we know.
Yep. Of witnessing that way.
Right, maybe. And they're there. And yes, here, and then here.
One of the changes that in sort of strange for a college professor to say this, but making things less cognitive and realizing all the different ways that it comes about, and determinism particularly has been helpful to us in looking at different ways of knowing, and we come to appreciate those more and to embody all of those different ways of knowing in the life of the church. I know when I grew up, you had to memorize all of our catechism.
Yes.
Yes. And it was, I'm not sure that we knew anything, but we knew how to recite it, as you said.
Mm-hmm.
But it was all cognitive. I mean,
but you know, there's another thing about what Paul was saying about the magic of words. I think that what I realized, I didn't understand some of that, but having those words were very powerful. They were very powerful. And think of some of the other changes we've made. I mean, I think we sort of, this is a natural unfolding of this dilemma. I say when I was little, we sat in a pew, and nobody, I don't think people really felt excluded. Then we kind of moved to this, especially since younger children were coming up for communion. Then they had a little brother. Some come up for a blessing. Then suddenly you really have, you see this vivid experience of being denied. Right, I mean, and I think that raised the question for children in a different way. And let me add, as you may have noticed, those of you who have small children, one of the dangers I've found is, you know, we do sort of think of children as readily accessible. I mean, people are always coming up and going, oh, you can't kill them. You know, and I've just, wait, I mean, every once in a while, I said, please, Lucy, don't hit him. But have you, pastors who've done this, have you ever just, when you go up to a child and you go to put your hand on their head, many times they really don't like it. They back away. And then I think, oh my gosh, now we've given them a substitute that actually feels invasive or sort of, do you know, rather than, I've noticed, I've been stunned at me, so that what would be, and that's what my friend said, I always kneel down and touch their shoulder so that they can see where my hand is. But to see how, it gets complicated, and then you finally have to come up to them and say, well, now wait a minute, do we have to have a gradations of what is appropriate? No, but I think this is a natural evolution. That's what I'm saying. And in many ways, I like to think of it as kind of what happens in our families between the first child and, say, the fourth. You know? Go ahead. It's not that big a deal anymore. That you know, we're evolving. As a Christian community has always had to do, to say, that's our work. You see, God has given us these, and our work is to take these things, build around them the practices that Lutherans have always said are adiaphora, things indifferent. Doesn't mean they're unimportant, but build around them the structures that will make sure they speak what we want them to speak, that they don't only articulate the word about justification, but they express themselves justifyingly. Okay? So that, of course, there have to be some changes. Michelle, please, you have your hand up.
Just amplifying what you've already said, some of the part of our conversation at our church about communion was adults who are mentally challenged, you know, and we wouldn't think of denying them communion. And so that colored our conversation about children as well.
Yes. Well, and you say that, let me say, there are people who would. There have been, I had a student who told me about an uncle he had who was a pastor who was proud of the fact that no matter how grave the temptations, he had never communed. What was called at the time a mentally retarded member of the congregation. Precisely because he couldn't eat in faith and therefore it wouldn't have been appropriate and wouldn't have been anything. And we sort of recoil in horror, but what I want to say is don't think those things are so far away, or why it shakes people that somehow or other you could take this. See, what bothers me is that this good gift of God, if somehow or other we administer it wrongly, see, these people are going to get, you know, and I want to say that's what really to me undermines a whole message of grace in it. It seems to me you could make a big mistake and it'd still be okay. But we're walking around this hallowed sacred, remember that the thing Martin read the other day about high churches, you know, he said that we sort of waltz up to God like Mohawks on the steel girders and sort of forget that this person could kill you, right? So that, I mean, there's also that sense of awe that be not too quick to mess with whole, which you want to say why we need to respect sometimes a very visceral reaction among quite a few members of our church about not taking seriously those injunctions, right? But I will offer you one last, this is the most vivid story I have ever heard in this respect. I had a student at Luther who had been active in the church for years and years and years, and the pastor who had been the most formative one for her contracted Alzheimer's disease. And it was moving quickly. As you know, sometimes it moves very quickly. And there's that horrible stage when you know you have it and you know what's happening. And she was with him once with his family, and he said to his wife, "Promise me when the time comes, and it is coming soon, that I no longer know Jesus, or know I'm in my mind, that you won't let them stop communing me." He said, "Because I believe when the time comes that I can no longer remember Jesus, he will still remember me." Right? I mean, and I thought to make that kind of witness before you slip into that dark night was unbelievable. Right? I think there's a way of saying before our children are in a place to remember, I mean, they have to know him before they can remember him. They're remembering, and they come together, that it grows in this fullness, and to say at the other end of the life as it ebbs away, even on those days when you and I go up there and don't have a clue why we're there, and you know you've had moments like that, what it's about, he's still there for us. He's still there for us. So I think that you're quite right. We all go in various stages of ignorance and unbelief, whatever that may mean. And that's why the supper was offered in the first place. You know, I mean, as Luther said, if you wait until you feel you're ready, you'll never go. And if you were ready, you wouldn't need to. Please, you take the last word. Well, thank you.